Hello, you gentle Pendergasts. Or Prendergast. How would you pronounce that fucking name? Welcome to the Blind Boy Podcast. I believe it's... Are we 46? Week 46. I don't know if you can hear the difference in fidelity or the sound this week. I'm not in my studio. I'm in a very, very fancy hotel room in the middle of London, in Saha. I'm in the Saha area of London, an area I know well. And I'm over here because I was interviewing the absolutely wonderful, magnificent director Spike Lee. And I'll be playing you that interview in a while. And if you don't know who Spike Lee is an African-American director. He'd be one of my fucking heroes because the man is a genius. He's an auteur in that one of these directors whereby he just, his voice and authority, he's like a novelist. Do you know, his voice and authority takes supreme over all other aspects of the film. Cinematography is fucking class, his storytelling is class, the whole shebang. If you're not versed in Spike Lee's films, I would recommend, you know, immediately watch Do the Right Thing, Clockers, Crooklyn, Summer of Sam, you know, incredible films. Even like, just to show you how much I adore fucking Spike Lee's work. We have a song called Fellas. And Fellas is... It features an animatronic puppet of Gabriel Byrne. And a puppeteer. And what I wanted with the video for Fellas, you see it on YouTube, is to create a kind of... What the song is about, it's about accepting one's sexuality. But the protagonist in this song and in this video, they aren't accepting their sexuality, and instead they act out their homosexuality through a puppet of Gabriel Byrne. But I wanted to create an atmosphere in the video of kind of a creepy, not creepy, but a seedy underground kind of gay club. And the cues that I took for that, when we were, you know, like storyboarding the video, there's a scene in Spike Lee's Summer of Sam. It's a montage where the song Baba O'Reilly by The Who is playing, and Adrian Brody is working in, he's dancing in like a gay club, but against his, he's not gay, he's a straight man, and he's doing this thing that he doesn't really want to do. He's uncomfortable in it, and he's effectively becoming a male sex worker. Nothing wrong with that, but Adrian Brody in the film Summer of Sam is doing it because he needs money, and it's quite depressing because there's not really consent under duress, if you get me. So for this scene, like, Spike Lee directed this, directly took like the lighting cues, the mood, the colouring, the framing, and I put that into the video, Fellas. So that's how much of a fanboy myself and Mr. Chrome are of Spike Lee's work. The interview that you're about to hear, the reason it kind of came about is because Spike is, he's got a film out in the cinemas. And I think it's out on the 24th of August. I could be wrong. It's very soon. I saw it already, but it's called Black Klansman. And it's brilliant. It's genuinely now, and I'm happy to say this, it's his best work in a number of fucking years. It's brilliant. Jordan Peele, who made Get Out, is producing it, and you can kind of see Jordan Peele's influence on it. You can get that flavour, that comic flavour. But it is a Spike Lee film, and or a Spike Lee joint, as he calls it. It's based on a true story, but it's semi-fictional. You know, you can tell that certain facts are embellished for the benefit of entertainment. But the one thing the film will do, and this is what makes it art, I suppose, you know, socially engaged art, it can, like, it's the story of a black policeman in the South who successfully infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan. And Topher Grace from That 70s Show plays David Duke, the leader of the KKK. He plays it fucking brilliantly. But that's what the film is about. But it's also contextualized in contemporary events, in particular the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville last year that left one person dead. And you will walk away from this film, how I walked away from it anyway, with a very constructive anger towards Nazis and white supremacists. In particularly, what the film does is it portrays how easily Nazis and white supremacists normalize their behavior by appearing acceptable, by appearing to be respectable, you know. And this film really, it lets you see the snake in the grass, and you leave with a good anger that makes you go, no, I'm not putting up with that. I don't care if your views are being espoused in a fucking mainstream newspaper. I don't care if you've got a shirt and tie. Your views are racist, and I won't stand for it. So that's what the film does. That makes it an incredibly beneficial piece of socially engaged art. Even though there is a bit of criticism against it, in particular from, is his name Boots Riley? Apologies if I got his name wrong. His first name is Boots. I think it's Boots Riley, but he's also a director, an African-American director. He's formerly from the band The Coup, and he had a lot of problem with the Spike Lee film. He felt that it wasn't historical enough in representing the actual story. He felt that it gave the police a bit of an easy slip. It didn't portray the police as being as brutal as they should be portrayed. So that's a valid argument. So anyway, yeah, how did the interview come about? Spike is in London and he's promoting this fucking film, and through some bizarre things, I ended up getting asked, will you interview Spike for the podcast? So I said, I fucking will. And the people who asked me have put me up in a lovely hotel in the middle of Saha, which is great. And that's where I'm recording this podcast. So I went in to interview Spike, nervous as fuck, to be honest. Very fucking nervous, because it's Spike Lee, someone I've been looking at the films. I've been looking at his films since I was about 12. The reason Spike is so important to me is, like, as you know from this podcast, I'm incredibly passionate about hip-hop music and hip-hop culture, and not just hip-hop, but pretty much all aspects of African-American culture I'm very passionate about, you know? And you know I get quite emotional and passionate about art and creativity. That's my vibe. And I grew up listening to hip-hop, you know? When I was a young kid, I would have had Ice-T, Public Enemy, Ice Cube. But growing up in fucking Limerick, where, you know, I'd have been listening to Ice-T fucking 6 years before even knowing what he looked like. You know, I would have had a few liner notes. I didn't even have liner notes. No, I was just given a cassette. So I just had the music. This, you know, speaking about these alien ghettos of America, where, and the struggle of that black people face. I only had it through audio. There was no internet for me to look it up. There wasn't really hip-hop magazines. Hip-hop wasn't being shown on television, hip-hop videos, not in the 90s when I was a kid. I didn't have all I had was this music and these tapes. That was it, just audio. But Spike Lee's films, they gave me a visual and cultural context for what rappers were speaking about, and it was hugely valuable to me. And it gave me a good critical eye for rap music at a young age, because the thing is with gangster rap is there's a slight performative element to gangster rap where it tends to highlight, in particular something like N.W.A., to highlight only the negative aspects of urban African-American culture. Whereas a Spike Lee film like Clockers is about, we'll say, gang life in Brooklyn, right? But what Clockers does and what makes it so amazing is the central character in Clockers, who's a dealer, he's got an ulcer and he has to drink milk of magnesia all day because it's like the opposite of glamorizing the gangster. It's like, yes, he's a gangster. Yes, he's selling crack. Yes, he walks around with a gun. But the stress of his job is so great that he has a fucking ulcer like some prick working in a bank. And seeing the humanity of that at a young age was very important to me in kind of adding a kind of a pinch of salt and a cultural context as to why certain gangster rap was the way it was, if you get me. Also as well, last week's podcast was about the origins of hip-hop in the Bronx. Spike Lee fucking grew up, you know, through that. He's from Brooklyn. He was present when, in New York, when hip-hop was happening and the disco was happening. So Spike got to speak a little bit on that. So yeah, I went to hotel in Soho to interview him, where he was doing many, many interviews. The past 3 days he's been here doing non-stop interviews. Before I went in with my fucking shitty podcast set up, Jonathan Ross was in before me interviewing him. My ma's in her late 70s. My ma got it into her head that I was interviewing Bruce Lee. So, and she also made me a bunch of, she thought I was interviewing Bruce Lee, but doesn't matter. She knew I was interviewing someone who, to me, was a fucking hero, you know? So she got that much, regardless of whether she thinks it's Bruce Lee or Spike Lee. But she made me a lot of scones with raisins in them, and demanded that these be given to Bruce Lee. So for the first half of the interview with Spike, he's chewing on shit. That's my mother's scones. So apologies for if that's annoying. He enjoyed them. So, have I anything else to say? Yeah, Black Klansman. Go and see it. Fucking great film. You won't be disappointed. Very entertaining. And thank you to Spike for doing the interview and for sponsoring one or two podcasts as well. A couple of episodes are sponsored by Spike. So, here is the interview. You can't. One last thing. The interview it's quite harsh on Irish Americans. And just so you know, I'm referring specifically to racist Irish Americans. If you are not a racist Irish American, because there's many Irish Americans that listen to this podcast, fine people. If you're not a racist, then when I say Irish American, it's not about you. This, when I say Irish American in this, I'm referring to racist fucking assholes who hate black people, but at the same time will talk about the oppression that their grandparents faced in Ireland and drink Guinness and all that performative shit while being shitheads. That's who that's about. But if you're a decent fucking Irish American who isn't a racist scumbag, then it's not about you. I just felt the need. I don't want to sully the interview if you're an Irish American listening, you know? And if you're a racist, you probably don't listen to the podcast anyway.
So you still live in Limerick?
I do, yeah.
Yeah? And you commute to London?
I commute to London, yeah. But with the internet, like, I can do all my work at home. Like, my main thing is this podcast. I record it in Limerick and I don't really need to leave, you know, and I like it. Actually, one thing...
How long have you been doing your podcast?
Only a year.
Yeah?
Only a year, yeah.
And you're a hit now, huh?
It's doing all right, yeah.
God bless. Like,
thank you very much.
What's your subject matter? Just interesting people or what?
No, I mainly, like last week, actually what I did was, because it was the 45 years of the history of hip, of the birth of hip-hop 2 weeks ago, what I did a podcast on...
In the South Bronx.
Yes. But what I did the podcast on was, I was just researching, and I found an article in the New York Times, and it was dated in, October 1973. And the headline of the article was, landlord accused of anti-black racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that was Donald Trump when he was 27.
Yeah.
So what I did is I looked at the fact that Trump was doing this in Brooklyn and Queens.
Right.
And then...
Him and his father.
Him and his dad, yeah.
Right.
But I found a kind of a connection between that and the fact that Kool Herc's parties, a lot of them were rent parties. So I was kind of going, Donald Trump and his kind of racist policies could have been a contributing factor to the birth of hip hop.
I wouldn't go that far, sir.
Yeah, it's a fucking, it's a reach. It's a reach.
That's a big reach.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to ask you about, because I was looking at New York in the 70s, okay? And in such a small period of time, you have the birth of disco in Greenwich Village coming out of, like, we'll say, the Stonewall Riots. Then you've got...
All the Year 77, which I made a film about that year. Summer of Sam.
Summer fucking Sam, I love it, yeah.
Thank you.
Then...
You had the Blackout.
The birth of punk. Right. That would have been... Was that Hell's Kitchen, CBGB's, whereabouts was that?
Yes.
And then you've got the birth of hip-hop.
Right.
Now...
That's in the Bronx. That was pointing out.
Yeah.
In Manhattan. Lower Manhattan.
Like, New York was in a bad time, but that was when New York was... was it in
broke.
Debt? Yeah, it was in broke.
Right.
Like, can you give your... Like, why did these three amazing art forms separately at the same time happen in this small area? Like, what's your read on that?
Timing. Everything is timing. I mean, I'm 61 years young, so I've come to believe that very few things happen by happenstance. So it's just a combustible time. New York City was broke. You had the Blackout.
Yeah.
The birth of disco. That was a summer 77 was the first summer disco. You had hip hop on the rise. You had Summer Sam, the psychopath that was killing people. That summer was so hot. I mean, it was so hot. And who knew that later on I'll make a film about that summer, Summer of Sam. But I think it was one of the glorious days, the glory days of New York City. And here's the thing between now. Back then, young artists like David Byrne, Madonna, people like that, young artists were drawn to New York. Young artists can't afford to come to New York anymore.
Yeah.
They got to go to Detroit. You could buy a house for $5 in Detroit. They go to Detroit. They go to Portland. They go to Seattle. They go to... in Texas. Where is that?
Houston?
Not Houston.
What's the hipster one? I know the one you're thinking of. South by Southwest is there.
Yes. It's where University of Texas is. I'm blanking on it. Anyway.
So am I.
Josh said, hey. And I've always felt that it was an influx of young artists that made New York great. And young artists can't afford to live in New York anymore.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Did you, like, when you were a kid growing up around that, did you get involved in either the disco scene or the hip-hop scene? Were you going to, like, did you go to any of these early hip-hop parties or?
The parties were in the street. Block parties.
Literally in the street?
In the street. They hook up the turntable, the speakers to the street lamps, and it's a block party. In fact, this coming Saturday, I'm going to have my 9th annual Brooklyn Loves Michael Jackson block party.
Yeah.
We've been doing it for 9 years. We do it for Prince. 3 years. So a block party, that's part of summertime, put the music out, dance, and have fun.
So even before hip-hop was a thing, this was happening. Like, when did it start? Like,
block parties, hip-hop and block parties, same thing. They start at the same time.
When did it start getting, like, a name? When did something happen to these block parties where you were going... Something new was happening. This is a new thing. Or was it even noticeable?
It was under the term of hip hop. Hip hop. What is hip hop? The foundation of hip hop is graffiti,
mm-hmm.
breakdancing, MCing, and DJing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the foundations of hip-hop. And hip-hop was born in the South Bronx by Puerto Rican, young black Puerto Rican and black males. So it's amazing that out of this one section of the Bronx, predominantly people of color, has grown this, who knows how many billion-dollar industry that's all over the world. And back then, those guys were just doing it for fun. No one could dream how much money could be made from back then.
How do you feel about how it has been monetized? Do you feel that has it been monetized?
You know it's been monetized.
Has that money been... Do you feel that, we'll say, the people that originated, people of color that originated, have they benefited from it, or do you feel that it's been monetarily appropriated in a different direction?
It's like anything happens in the record industry. You know, the record company, you know, they make the money. But I think that artists today are a lot smarter with their money, because a lot of those pioneers from the hip-hop era, they're broke. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not doing very well. Mm-hmm. But no one knew the money we made from it. You were just doing it for fun. To express yourself.
Yeah. Would you think that, like, out of that New York recession, that boredom was a driving factor in expression?
No, I don't think boredom had anything to do with it. You just... For me, I don't think boredom comes out of... I don't think expression comes out of boredom. I think that to express yourself is something that we have all we have within us, that all humans have within us. And we just have different ways of displaying that.
Yeah.
I don't think there were guys who were rapping or scratching or spinning their head because they were bored. They knew that this was something new, an art form.
Yeah. Your own process as an artist, has that changed much over the years?
It's changed because technology has changed. When I used to edit on a flatbed. Now you have Avids, you have digital stuff. But the basics have the same, which is don't take any shortcuts, do the work, and keep building your craft. Mm-hmm. Craft, for me, craft is so much. And so... I'm going to my fourth decade as a filmmaker, and I'm a cinephile. In addition to making films, I'm a professor of film. I'm a tenured professor of film at New York University Graduate Film School, where Ang Lee and I were classmates, same class of 82. And I just love cinema. I love teaching it. I love doing it. And I say this all the time, I feel very blessed, because a lot of people don't have or never get the opportunity to do what they love.
Yeah.
A lot of people on this God's earth go to their grave, have worked at a job, they slayed that all their life. So when you can make a living doing what you love, you won. That's my opinion.
Yeah. What did Bob Dylan said something similar. Bob Dylan said that if you get up in the morning and you go to bed at night, but in the middle you did that thing that you love, then you're a success.
Bob Dylan. Yeah. I'm with you, Bob. My father played with Bob Dylan.
No way.
My father, at one point, was a top jazz bassist. Excuse me, a top folk bassist. Played with Bob Dylan, Gordon Lightfoot, Joan Baez, Judy Collins, Peter. You know that song, Peter Paul, Perry Puff the Magic Dragon?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My father's on bass.
Fucking hell.
Yes, Bill Lee.
Was that New York based? Was he?
Yeah, New York.
And that was down in Greenwich Village when all that shit was happening?
Yes, a lot of clubs there, the recording studios. And when Bob Dylan went electric, everybody else did.
Yeah.
And my father refused his day, has never plucked a note on a Fender bass.
Really? He's traditionalist?
Traditionalist. So here's the thing, though. My father had five children and a wife.
Yeah.
I'm the oldest. So when he refused to play Fender bass, my mother had to work.
Yeah.
Because my father, he let us starve.
He put his fucking principles ahead of money.
I know, but sir. He has five children.
Yeah.
little children.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother had to start the work. She started to teach because we would have starved.
Fucking hell.
So I'm conflicted about my father.
Yeah.
Because I understand his principles.
Yeah.
But you have five kids.
I know. Just plug it in.
What?
Just plug it in. Plug in the bass, man.
He couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. But it ended up a good story because my father ended up doing the scores for my films. My father did the music, all my NYU films. My father did the score. She's Gotta Have It. School Days and his score for Do the Right Thing and Mo Better Blues.
Brilliant.
So we ended up working together once I became a filmmaker.
And
but he called it tone as is. He was not going to play any instrument that was electrified. Couldn't do it.
Fucking hell. I mean, I can't even.
I'm talking about hardcore hardliner.
Yeah.
Acoustic.
Yeah.
Everything had to be acoustic. In fact, people perform, people get mad because he wouldn't put up a microphone on his bass.
That's pretty exceptional.
Hardcore.
And that's just old school. But I mean, there's so much, like, with double basses as well, there's like crazy tradition around them. Like, isn't, you can inherit strings and stuff. Yeah. Like, you keep strings on a double bass for like 100 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas with an electric bass, that's a bad thing. You got to change the strings.
And in fact, so we were little, we had a record player, so we had this sneak. We'd be playing the Beatles and Motown. He would say, "Turn that bad music off." It's okay, Daddy. So we turn it down lower so he could hear it.
What would he have thought of, we'll say, someone like Miles Davis,
who was... Oh, he knew Miles.
But Miles was fusing, we'll say, the tradition with the more modern stuff.
But he always had, even when Miles was elected, they had respect for each other. In fact, I did a music video for Miles called Tutu. And Miles Davis was notorious for like cursing you. You curse your ass out. You say, "Spike, I'm not going to call you a motherfucker because I know your father. I dig your father." Swear to God, true story.
Fucking hell.
So did he know Miles gave me some slack because he knew my father, respected my father.
And what about like Herbie Hancock?
He knew all those cats.
Herbie was from the Bronx, wasn't he?
I think Chicago. I don't know. But all those guys, even now, when they see me, they say, "Yeah, you know, tell, make sure. How's your father doing? Tell your father I said okay."
So wow. He's still...
But people knew him. He was one of the top. You could play his ass off. He wasn't going to be electric.
And would he have been pure jazz? Would he have been interested in blues as well? Or
It all comes from the blues. So
yeah,
I mean, he was. It all comes from that. That's
and is your dad from New York or
no? My father was born in Snow, Alabama. And so I was born in Atlanta. I grew up, moved to Brooklyn. My family moved to Brooklyn when I was like 2 or 3 years old. But and my mother died when I was in college. If you see this film, look at this film called Crooklyn. You haven't seen it. It's about...
Oh, I know Crooklyn,
That's my family that film's about.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So, but the little girl, is that little girl you?
No, that was my sister.
Okay.
She was the only girl out of five children.
Cool. I got some of the questions I have are from the people on the internet, right? So some of them are strange questions. Mm. One question is, can you ask Spike if he remembers drinking with an Irish lad in Tokyo?
No.
No. Okay, so to that person on the internet who...
No, they might be telling the truth. I just don't remember.
You just don't remember it, yeah.
I remember.
Well, he remembers drinking with Spike Lee in Tokyo.
Well, if I did, it might have been one beer because I don't really drink.
No, you don't like drink?
There's a line. Have you ever seen the film 25th Hour?
I haven't seen that one, no.
There's a line where Barry Pepper's Irish. And the guy says, "Will you stop drinking?" He says, "Are you drunk?" He says, "I can't get drunk. I'm Irish."
Yeah, we call that functioning alcoholism back in Ireland.
You guys can knock it back.
We do. We have, our culture is to develop a tolerance for it. Which in other
How old were you had your first drink?
Maybe 12 or 13.
Guinness?
Whiskey. No, whatever's going.
What, you remember what it was?
Probably some shit beer. Some shit, like, just really cheap beer.
Not the good stuff?
No, I like Guinness as I got older. I got to develop an appreciation for it, but...
A deep appreciation?
Yeah, I do. I very, very much... I like a drink, you know?
You're Irish!
Yeah, of course.
Is that stereotypical to say that?
Look,
I'm asking you.
That's the thing. It's like... It is, but it's also a huge part of our culture. Mm-hmm. It's like if a Jamaican dude, if you say a Jamaican dude is smoking weed, it's right. like, yes, it is a stereotype, but they tend to smoke a lot of weed. And it's the same with the Irish. I think what it is like if a British person said it, it's when there's negative connotations around it. Yeah. It's like you
all,
can't.
I'm all. That's why I come from a place of positivity. So I hope you didn't take that as a stereotype.
No.
Yeah, cool. We good, right?
Good? Yeah, of course. We're good, yeah. I think what it is yeah, if it was like a British person saying, you can't work here, you'll get drunk, then it's bad.
Right, but if
it's someone going, you're Irish, you like to drink, let's party, then it's good, but it's two sides of
the
same
coin. What is the situation? Educate me, because I'm glad we're doing this. What is the situation today between Ireland and the UK?
Politically, it's 800 years of colonization.
So see that word again?
Colonization.
There you go.
And
which Britain knows a lot about.
Yeah, Britain knows an awful lot about. Even look, the wall behind, I was only pointing out here, that's Orientalist. You know, that's their colonizing of both. Just to describe to the listeners, it's in India.
India, you had to get the tea.
But you've Chinese things in there too. And you've got a peacock. It's mixed in all the elements of the Orient into one.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the wall in this room.
The wall in this room, yeah, is an Orientalist motif, and it's just it's pure British colonialism. But it's one thing I wanted to raise with you is Irish Americans. Now, Irish have a weird relationship with the British, but what Irish people also have a strange relationship with is Irish Americans, in particular. How
there's
Irish
friction between Irish Americans and Irish people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
about what?
How racist they are.
Irish Americans?
Yeah.
Woo.
Come on.
I said woo.
Yeah.
I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah.
There's been very even, I'll give you an example. Boston?
Yeah.
Irish Americans. And historically, there's been friction between the black people
very
in Boston.
Bad.
And the Irish American boss. I mean, that's like for me. That when you said that, that jumped to my mind immediately.
Or the New York draft riots. One thing when I saw Scorsese's film, the fuck's it called? Gangs of New York.
Gangs of New York.
I knew the history.
They left a lot of it out.
He whitewashed loads of it.
They shot it, but they cut it out the film.
Really?
Yeah, they shot all that stuff with the.
I'm going to be interviewing a woman soon. Her name is Bernadette Devlin, and she wasn't a member of the IRA, but she would have been, we'll say, on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1970s, when the Irish Americans gave support to Ireland in the, we'll say, the war, the insurgency against Britain, they brought over a lot of activists from Ireland to New York. So mm-hmm. all the Irish Americans were going, "Oh, we'll support you, we'll support you." But Bernadette Devlin went to New York and said to the Irish Americans, "My people are not the Irish Americans. My people are the blacks and the Chicanos. And you are treating the blacks and Chicanos the way that we are being treated at home." And the Irish Americans didn't
like it.
That
did not go over well, did it?
No. The mayor of New York gave her the key to the city.
Who?
I don't know who the fuck it was. No, this would have been
Bloomberg?
71 or 72.
Abe Beam.
Probably. She took,
or John Lindsay, maybe one of anyone.
She took the key in New York and she went to Harlem and she gave it to the Black Panthers.
Yeah?
Yeah. So I'm going to be interviewing
her soon.
She's
a guest?
She's a guest on this podcast.
Please
yeah.
tell her Spike Lee.
She'd be thrilled to find that out, yeah.
But another thing I would like to add. The thing about New York was very strange because immigrants came to America through New York, Ellis Island. And so right away, the groups took that thing. So sanitation, Irish going to have that.
Yeah.
No, the Italians had that. The
we
teachers,
had the cops.
The teachers, yeah, the teachers were Jewish. But the cops
yeah.
were Irish. And so that contributed to the friction between the Irish American community in New York and with the African American, because the Irish were the cops.
Yeah. There's a fantastic book called How the Irish Became White, which is, it shows that when the Irish were coming to America in the 17th or 18th century, they came from...
They were, can I just say this? They were considered niggas.
Pretty
because
much.
Whoever was the last group in, you were at the bottom.
Yeah.
And it became, you could say, maybe the American story of immigrants, where you try to, the Jews came, the Irish came, the Italian Americans, and they're trying to, so whoever just comes behind you.
Yeah. And the Irish came from a system called the penal laws, which would be similar. It would be very similar to Jim Crow.
Right.
That type of system. And when the Irish came to America from this, you know, knowing nothing other than oppression, that's the first time they came across the color line.
Right.
And what they say is that the Irish earned their whiteness in American society by acts of brutality against the black community.
Let me ask you a question. What is black Irish?
Black Irish.
I never understood that term.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Well, it can mean two things. In Ireland, what black Irish means is the Spanish tried to help us fight the British like 200 years ago. So there was a Spanish ship called the Armada. Right. It was bolstered. It got shipwrecked in Ireland. So it's people who have black hair in Ireland are called the Black Irish.
Okay.
The other thing it can mean is there's a theory that the Irish people genetically, we come from like Morocco and Algeria.
Right.
And then in America, I think what it means is, we'll say people from like the Five Points 200 years ago,
yeah,
where they're both sharing the same place in the intermarriage.
With the
yeah,
former slaves, right?
But like what I say to Irish Americans, when I see Irish Americans now, because we're very embarrassed by Irish Americans, especially when we see people like, you know, all Ryan, all these fucking names in the White House. And
Irish.
They're all fucking Irish. The worst cons are fucking Irish in America. And what we get pissed...
I know it's all about it like that.
It is. But for us, it's embarrassing because our kind of thing as a society is that we know oppression as
being
a people.
Colonized.
Yeah, we were colonized.
How many years? 300 years, right?
Yeah, 800 years. So for us, it's very...
How much? 800?
800 years, yeah.
Shit.
And so it's annoying for us to kind of see it. No, we get pissed off when we see them calling themselves Irish. Because what we remind them of is there was a guy called Daniel O'Connell in 1840. And he's known as the Irish Emancipator. He emancipated us. And he used to bring Frederick Douglass to Ireland.
What?
Yes. And Frederick Douglass was in Limerick.
My man, you're educating Spike. I'm telling you. I did not know that Frederick Douglass came to Ireland.
He did.
Damn!
And this is what you need to say to an Irish American the next time you see an Irish American talking shit. So he.
What do you think of St. Patrick's Day parade?
I mean, it's good, but I mean, again, black Americans don't like St. Patrick's Day parade because it's just another white people doing their white shit, isn't it?
Getting drunk.
Yeah. Pissing. Well, again, it's Irish Americans kind of almost appropriating our culture in a way as well because they're becoming a caricature, and then we look at it going, that's kind of silly.
Can I ask you a question? Is there, this is what I'm hearing from you, is this a dialogue that's happening now between... Mm-hmm. Irish Americans and
big time
and national,
yeah,
Irish.
Because
where?
On the internet, because yeah, we've never really seen it before. We've never known how actually racist they are. They became the overseer. That's what they did. Like I was thinking.
So
of fucking,
what do Irish Americans say when native Irish people say you blokes?
They don't know what to say.
What
they don't know what to say. What
you say? You are racist.
They don't know what to say. They say...
They have nothing to come back on?
There's two things they bring up. Now, the first thing, what I say to them, and this is what pisses them off, I bring up when Daniel O'Connell used to bring Frederick Douglass, the purpose of that visit was... This is 1840, so Irish people, dirt poor, had never seen a black person. There was no newspapers, nothing. So Daniel O'Connell would bring Frederick Douglass on tours of Ireland, and he would say, this man here. And they'd go, wow, I've never seen someone like that before. And he would say... I know most of the year going to America next year. When you go to America, if you see people like him, that's a common struggle. You must join with these people, these black
what?
People.
What's
yes.
this guy's name?
Daniel O'Connell. And him and Frederick Douglass toured Ireland and he said...
I gotta get on...
Yeah. Google. Oh man, it'd be some story.
I'm gonna give you my email.
Yeah, do.
So please send me information.
I will.
Because what you're telling me, I did not know.
It's an incredible story. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do actually in Limerick is the place where Frederick Douglass spoke is a restaurant and I'm trying to get a plaque put there to commemorate it. But Daniel O'Connell said...
The same restaurant?
Yeah. It used to be like a church.
Yeah.
So Daniel O'Connell said to the Irish people, if you go to America next year and you do not help men who look like this, you can no longer consider yourself Irish. That's what I say to the Irish Americans. So
what,
you,
what they say, fuck you.
I say you went to America. You, instead of aligning yourself with other oppressed people, you chose to find the color line and find your whiteness by oppressing black people. Mm. Therefore, you gave up your Irishness at that moment. So you're a Yank. You're not an Irish person. They go fucking apeshit. They can't handle it. But the other thing that is, have you heard the Irish slaves myth?
Educate me again, sir.
So that this is another huge dialogue between Irish people and Irish Americans. This thing has happened in the past 4 or 5 years where Irish people will say to black people, my ancestors were slaves too. And it's ahistorical. What happened was Irish people were sent, it was about 250,000 Irish people were sent to the colonies of Barbados and Jamaica. That's why Jamaican accents sometimes sounds a little bit Irish.
Right.
But the thing is, Irish people were sent as indentured servants. Mm. They worked on the plantation, they worked alongside African slaves, but they could work for their freedom in maybe 15, 20 years.
Right.
They were not chattel.
Right.
There was no generational fucking system that's still seeing the effects of today. Mm-hmm. That's what the Irish Americans don't get. They go, well, my ancestors were slaves too. So, but essentially what they're making is a fucking very racist biological argument to suggest that they had the same struggle and their whiteness and superiority.
But
as
there
well.
Was intermarriage between that, between Irish and
yeah, there was intermarriage. But often what happened with the Ireland as a nation never engaged in the slave trade as a nation.
Right.
But those indentured servants that went to Barbados, what do you think they did when they got their 15 years freedom? They went and became fucking slave owners. They became the overseers.
Right.
And then those dudes, actually, this will interest you. The people that would have oppressed the Irish, we refer to them now as orange men, okay? They're the big thing in Ireland is that if you were oppressed, you were a native Irish Catholic. But who was oppressing them were, from England and Scotland, Protestants.
Right.
And their leader was called King William, King Billy. So a lot of these oppressors of the Irish moved to Mississippi, the southern states. They were the Scotch-Irish. They were essentially British.
Were they a Confederacy?
Yes.
A Confederate.
But all their names were fucking Billy.
Right.
Because of King William. That's what a fucking hillbilly is. Uh-huh. And
that's where hillbilly comes from?
Yeah.
What?
These cunts that were oppressing...
Oh my God.
You, King
my,
William...
Can I just say this? As we stay in New York, you've been dropping signs.
I look...
My man's dropping signs, ladies and gentlemen, because I'll tell you, he's telling me shit. I just found out the origin of the word hillbilly.
Yeah, it's because of King William. The people that would have been oppressing the Irish, they went, I'm not going to say they founded the fucking clan because that's a lot of a reach, but the culture that the clan would have come from.
Close.
It is quite close because we had the Irish penal laws that went... That was studied and became Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. It had been done before, as right. is always the system. But that's what...
Can you say it again? It had been done before?
It's just repeating the same fucking system.
Again.
And...
Like divide and conquer.
Divide
same
and conquer.
Same thing.
Yeah. It's the same fucking thing. Another thing that might interest you. Like the phrase, do you dig? You dig.
Yeah.
That comes from the Irish word, on digging to, which means understand. It's from the 5 points. So the 5 points in New York, you would have had native Irish speakers mixing with freed slaves.
Right.
So some words that are in African-American vernacular, you would find the roots in the Irish Gaelic.
Oh, my God.
Digging, yeah.
You dig, that's my shit right there.
Yeah, you're saying that's an Irish word. I'm digging to. But this is what kind of...
But you know what, though? My grandmother lived to be 100 years old. She used to say that her grandfather was an Irishman.
Mm-hmm.
You know where she was born?
Where?
Dublin, Georgia.
Yeah. Swear that's that weird. God. Yeah, I know. It's weird
my
shit.
My grandmother, who lived 100 years old, who put me through college and film school, she was born in Dublin, Georgia.
But here's the thing, Spike. You know if it's called Dublin, that means it was one of the bad ones that did it. Because a poor Irish man did not get the name of town. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like Baltimore. Baltimore literally means in Irish, Balia T. Moore, which is the big house. So, like, it's...
Whoa, whoa, whoa,
yeah.
Whoa.
More
science. Baltimore. Break it down again.
So Balia is like home, T is house,
right,
and Moore is big. So Balia T Moore.
The big house.
Baltimore.
And you know who lived in the big house? Mazza.
There you go.
Yeah.
So this is what kind of...
How old are you, if I might ask? You...
I do a lot of reading. I like my history.
There you go.
I like my history.
Why don't... You know, we got a president, and this guy doesn't read a book.
I know, he's a fucking idiot, yeah. Yeah.
Give me an Irish word for... What's the Irish equivalent for a motherfucker?
Oh, Amadon. Amadon, it would mean fool. Yeah, Amadon.
I like motherfucker better.
Motherfucker's nice, yeah. But this shit is why...
Our engineer, she's dying laughing over here. You know what? If you want to laugh, let it out. It doesn't make it good because you're
dying
laughing.
You're worried that like I give a fuck if your laugh is on it. Give a shit.
Let it out because there's some funny shit here.
But this is why we have this. The Irish have this complicated relationship with Irish Americans, because if you know your fucking history, you know that there was, for a small time, a shared understanding and an opportunity for solidarity. Mm-hmm. That, and we did not do that. We basically said. You see it now today. Even, like, we in Ireland, we've only been getting immigrants for the past 10 years because we've been a poor country. Mm-hmm. So a lot of immigrants may be Polish people. If a Polish man wants to be more Irish, the best thing he can do is give out about an Arab or give out about a Muslim or complain about them.
Right.
And that's what the Irish did.
It's the same old thing.
It's how do you identify with the oppressor or oppress who's being oppressed?
Mm-hmm. So what's the... What's the vibe in Ireland now, then?
We're just recovering from a recession. It's changing. Let me ask another way.
What's the vibe amongst young people? Young people in Ireland. Are they trying to come to London? They want to get out?
We're always immigrating. We're always leaving. You know, we've got one of the biggest diasporas in the world. So we're always leaving.
Because what's wrong that people got to go? No future or?
Yeah, no future. I mean, we're a small country. We never colonized anyone, so we don't have this massive load of fucking wealth. And as well, it's post-colonial. We don't have a true independence. We keep looking. When the British left us, we gave all our power to the Catholic Church. And that was a huge amount of abuse as well. We never got a chance to talk about the fucking film.
So does a Catholic Church run?
Now it's gone. Now, when we found out that the level of abuse that was being done, now we've all turned our backs. It's quite a liberal country. We legalized gay marriage. We've got abortion, things like that, which wouldn't have happened in Ireland maybe 20 years ago, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
is there a progressive move?
Yeah.
There is?
Big time.
Good.
Can I ask you one question about the film?
Please do.
I loved it. I absolutely fucking enjoyed it. What was the overall message you wanted? Because it's not 100% fact.
Right.
There's elements of fiction there, and I could tell that it was a clear narrative, especially the way that you portrayed Adam Driver's character.
Yes.
You made a point of letting us know he's Jewish, and even though he's white, these KKK cunts want to kill him too. What's the thinking behind that?
Jews are a close second to black people.
Yeah.
As far as the Klan goes.
But because you finished it with Charlottesville, were you looking for like a message of inclusion rather than division? Was that a message for white allies?
Oh, yes.
To go, you're next. So you don't get to just
I mean, hate is hate. And what happened in Charlottesville on August 12th, We hadn't started to shoot the film yet.
Yeah.
We didn't start till September. Charlottesville happened August 12th.
So it was an afterthought to kind of throw that in?
No, it was before.
Okay.
Charlottesville happened before. And so when it happened, I knew even though we'd not commenced shooting, I knew it had an ending because of Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And there's a history, though. If we go back to... I had a guy interview me today. He's wearing a T-shirt of John Brown.
Yeah.
Who led the revolt at Harpin's Ferry, a white man. So there's a history of black and white people who are progressive coming together. It's not new. I mean, John Brown, that was like 18 who knows when. So it happened to the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
During the 60s. So, and historically, especially in the 60s, you really had a tight coalition between Jews and blacks, which is not the same as today, but back then it was. So it wasn't far-fetched for Ron Stoller's character to be Jewish. Plus, add another layer. Adam Driver's character is playing the white Ron Stoller.
Yeah.
So he's code-switching there. Also, he's Jewish.
Yeah.
So he has two things that he's, you know, hiding from the Klan.
And what's your response to, we'll say, some criticism has said that you went a bit easy on the police, that you should have gone harder on the police. What do you say to that?
That, here's the thing, though. This film is a true story. And Ron Stallworth, I can't make him out to be Kwame Ture, which we've seen in the film. That's not him.
Yeah.
But we do see, there's a scene where he says, he asks him about this guy Landis, that, yeah, he killed a black kid. But we're not gonna do nothing about it, you know, because that'd be breaking the blue wall. And then what people are missing is that when we show that altercation, August 12th, I'm gonna use an Irish word. It was a Donnybrook.
Yeah.
Where were the cops?
Yeah.
Where was law enforcement?
Yeah.
There was no way around. And I've been very critical of police. We saw that in Malcolm X. We saw that in Do the Right Thing. But
yeah,
I'd have to hammer that point already. When people just turn on television and see stories about black people being shot in the streets left and right. So I'm very, you know, at peace with what we did with this film. I think that, on the other hand, I've never been the one that said I hate police. Mm-hmm. We need police.
Yeah.
We just need people who can't be, you know, kill people and not think about it because of the color of their skin. So, with my body of work, especially amongst black folks, you know, they think that Spike Lee should do this.
Yeah.
And Spike Lee do that. And my thing is like, there's 45 million African Americans. We're not one monolithic group. And it's okay if I do something that you don't like.
Yeah.
That's it.
So you're comfortable with criticism. You're able to...
I'm very Spike comfortable. Lee. I mean, I've been at it 32 years, so, you know... After
How were
a while,
you with criticism when you were younger? Did you find it affected your creativity?
No, it didn't affect my creativity. What it did was get me mad, which is like a device that what Trump, what those guys do, they get you... Lose your focus. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Why am I worrying about what this person said? I should be like, I learned it later on, but I didn't know at the beginning. Like, I was like, fuck you. Now, I just keep stepping.
Well done. Good
all
man.
Right. I'm going to give you my email, right?
Cause yeah.
I want you to send me all the...
I'm going to give you a copy of my book, too, if you don't mind.
You got it on you?
I do, yeah.
Can you sign it for me, please?
I would love to sign a fucking book.
Thank you. This is the best interview I had this trip.
Thanks very much.
Yes. Yeah. And that's not bullshit. That's real.
Thank you, Spike.
No. Thank you. Thanks, my brother.
Thank you.
Let's do it again, all right?
All right.
Okay.
And like that, he was gone. And... His minder. Hold on, my microphone is acting the prick. I've got an awful setup here in this hotel room. So, like, his minder came in and started looking at the watch. We only had 40 minutes together. But we clicked. And I tell you what, lads, and I knew by the look in his fucking eyes, that was a man who wanted to go for a pint. He wanted to go for a fucking pint. I know he said he doesn't drink that much. That is a man, by the end of that conversation, with so much fucking crack, he wanted to go for a pint. And I nearly chased him down the hall and said it to him. Like, we were just across the road from fucking Soho Theatre, which is, that's my stomping ground. You know, I'm well looked after in Soho Theatre. Could have gotten us a snug and a fucking pints for free all night and continued the conversation. But he had to go. He's fucking, Spike is doing non-stop interviews for the next 2 days to promote the fucking film. And I'm just fucking sickened. Sickened. Pints with Spike Lee after Soho Theatre. Get a few in, then fucking drag him off to an IRA bar in Cricklewood. See some trad. That's the evening I would have wanted, because we had fucking crack. We clicked. And it was a pleasure. It was magnificent. So, alright, that's it. That's the fucking podcast. Thank you for listening. We didn't have a chance for... We'll do the ocarina pause, alright? You better believe I brought the ocarina to London with me. So we'll do our little ocarina pause, if there's any digital adverts for the British Army, alright?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So that was the ocarina pause. And also, if you enjoyed the podcast, please support it through the Patreon page. Patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. I do about 5 hours of content for free a month. If you feel like, you know, if you're listening to that and going, geez, that was good crack, I would buy Blind Boy a pint or a cup of coffee. If you would feel that way, then the way to do it is through the Patreon page, and that supports this podcast. And if you can't afford it, that's fine. You can listen for free. That's how it works. Anything else I wanted to say? Yeah, so in that podcast, we touched a lot upon Irish and racism, and Irish Americans and racism, and I mentioned... There's a few things in there actually that historically that are a bit... Now, I've since mailed Spike Lee with some information with the history and shit. But there's a few things that are probable but not confirmed. So, on digging to, turning into dig. That again, probable but not confirmed. It's one of those things that's hard to completely test. Orange men, you know, being called William, turned into hillbillies. Again, highly probable, hard to confirm. And anything else in there? That's about it. But the other thing I spoke about was, you know, how the Irish people, you know, as a nation, the Irish, you know, we as a country, we never got involved in the slave trade. So a lot of Irish people think, oh, brilliant, we get a free pass then. Do you know? No white guilt for us. We didn't do anything to anyone. Well, historically, yeah, we were too busy being colonized to do anything particularly mean to someone else, which we absolutely would have done if we weren't being colonized, because that's what, you know, that's what humans do. Humans are just shitheads who colonize other people if they can. But... we don't get a free pass because currently in Ireland there is a very shameful system known as direct provision. And direct provision is, it's a way for Ireland to meet international laws for accommodating asylum seekers in the most minimal way possible. And you end up with people of colour essentially kind of just fucking imprisoned in this really shitty system that's happening in Ireland now with quite a bit of secrecy around it. And I think direct provision is going to be, it's going to be our Magdalene laundries in 10 years. Some dark shit is going to come out. But what I would ask of you, find out, people living in direct provision, they get, I think it's something like €19 a week. And there's a lot of kids who grew up and were born in direct provision. And these are kids who could have war trauma, you know, from Afghanistan and shit too. But they're going to school. They're going to school in September. And if you look for your local kind of charity that's helping with refugees, in Limerick, I believe it's Doris are the people that are doing it. Look at these people and what they're doing at the moment. They're trying to gather school bags and school books. They're trying to look for donations for school bags and school books for kids that are in direct provision who are going to be entering national school in September. I urge you to please donate to this cause. And I tell you why. Just think of it this way. If you're 3 or 4 years of age, maybe five years of age, from Afghanistan or the Congo, and you're already different, you're already entering school by being different because you physically look different and you're culturally different, so that's tough enough going into school, and you're fucking 3 or 4 years of age, which is when, you know, we form our personalities. Now imagine on top of that, you're the one who has the shitty books, the shitty clothes, doesn't have a school bag because you're too poor. That's what these kids in direct provision are going to be facing in September. So please help. Find your local direct provision support group and donate school books, book vouchers, school bags, whatever you can. Because what you're doing is you're buying these kids dignity. That's what you're not getting them things. You're giving them the dignity to walk into that schoolyard at the earliest age of their life and to at least feel equal to the other children. Don't let these little kids be the ones with the bag that has holes in it or the books that are clearly fucking third hand and falling apart. Don't let that happen on top of the fact that they're already different, because that will shape their personalities as they become adults, and it will shape those personalities negatively, and that is a system. And if you want to stop that system in 20 years, then intervene now when they're children and just try your best. First of all, obviously, to fucking end direct provision. But secondly, while it is happening, assist the children that are in direct provision so they have the dignity of being the same as other kids. Please do that. All right? I leave you go. That was an enjoyable podcast. I love talking to Spike Lee. I hope to one day have a fucking pint with him when he comes to Ireland. That would be magnificent. God bless.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.